Okay, so tonight we're taking up some basic ideas pertaining to Chayei Sarah, which literally is the life of Sarah, but really the main point that it's making, it's talking about the death of Sarah. So I wanted to take up some of the main points in two chapters. That is the first chapter in Chayei Sarah, which is essentially about the death of Sarah, but it's interesting. It doesn't really go into, I mean, you're sort of expecting that you're going to hear things about Sarah. And especially when it tells us that Avram came to eulogize Sarah and Livkosa, to cry for her. But I'm looking forward to hearing, I would really like to hear the eulogy. What did Avram have to say about Sarah? She's one of the greatest women people in our history. And to get a eulogy from Avram, would have been really an amazing thing. But the Torah doesn't always, sometimes it actually disappoints you. It doesn't always provide you with the things that you're hoping for. And then immediately, that's the end of that. We don't hear really anything about Sarah. But the next thing is he's involved in the attempt to secure a burial place. That's, well, as you know, that the burial place of Sarah and Avram, all the Avos, the patriarchs and the matriarchs, and according to our tradition, Adam and Eve are buried there as well. The only one who's not buried, who wasn't buried there of the patriarchs, matriarchs, yeah, Rachel. That's a different story. And she was buried in Beth Lechem. So that the Torah records a tremendous amount about the way in which Avram sought to acquire. So it's interesting in general because sometimes the Torah is exceedingly brief, hardly gives you any, you'd like to hear more information. And over here, the Torah is very informative. In this case, everything that he did, the negotiations to obtain the burial place, which doesn't really at first glance seem to be that important. So that kind of thing will always strike me as a question. Then you have the next chapter in Chayei Sarah is the search for a wife for Yitzchak. That's what I really want to go into a bit because I think the Torah over here expresses a great deal about its philosophy with regard to choosing one's spouse. So I think that's of interest and relevance to everybody. The question, of course, is there any connection between the two? That is, the story of the search for a wife, is juxtaposed to the story of the death and burial of Sarah. So we'll see if there's anything
there. Seems like it at the end, but okay.
Well, yeah, we want to see what the
connection
is specifically. Now, just some brief points, because my main focus is really going to be on the next chapter. The one about Eliezer's search for a wife. But there, too, you have a tremendous amount of detail. Which, again, is unusual. Okay. Now, just a few points pertaining to the first chapter we're doing, the death of Sarah. So it says that Avram came to eulogize Sarah and to cry for her. Okay, so apparently he was in Be'er Sheva, and she was in Hebron, whatever. That's why it says that he came. Although, of course, you would expect, why does the Torah have to tell you that? I don't know. I just like to notice all the questions, because eventually, hopefully, these seemingly small details will fit in. But right now, it doesn't matter. I'm sorry?
You're saying they were living in separate places at the time?
At the time, they weren't separated. That's not what I meant.
Living in separate places.
I'm sorry?
You're saying living in separate places, or they just happened to be?
I don't remember if I said the word living, but if you heard it, I probably said it. They were, and they had found them. He was in Be'er Sheva after the Akedah. This takes place after the Akedah.
Oh, I guess in close proximity then. Okay.
Yeah, and for whatever reason, she was in Hebron.
Okay.
Because the Torah is saying that he had to come to where she was. Okay. But why? It could have been just as well if the Torah had omitted it. What's the difference? Whether, right. Of course, he would come to where she was to attend to her burial. All right. But it's interesting that it says that to eulogize and to cry. What about the order? Is that the natural order of how a person reacts when somebody close passes away?
I heard this particular idea before, so I don't want to say anything.
Oh, okay. I don't know where you hear it. Not from me.
maybe from Robert Rosenthal. I'm not sure.
We've studied together a lot over the years. Right. It's possible. I'll also say briefly, for the sake of those who hadn't heard it, I would say that, of course, he cried. That's the natural reaction of a person as soon as you hear the news of somebody important. Obviously, she was extremely important. So it's just human nature to cry. The Torah doesn't record that because there's no need to. So that's what I would call the emotional reaction. And that's true. Anyone that was played any kind of a significant role, even if you don't like them that much, but you cry because the death of a person evokes a lot of emotions. So you may be surprised. It may be that consciously you didn't think that this person meant that much to you, or that you're going to miss that person that much. And then you can find yourself going into some kind of a depression, whatever the case is. And you realize that there's a lot of unconscious feeling over there. So I'm not saying that by Avram. I mean, he loved Sarah. So of course he cried. But then there's the next phase, which is eulogy. Eulogy is an intellectual process when you have to, you think into the character of the person, what that person stood for, and what they accomplished, and things of that sort. So that's a different, that evoked another crying. That was not just a emotional crying, but that was a recognition of the vastness of the loss. Okay, is that what you heard?
actually, no, I heard it was a perfection in Avraham that he eulogized her publicly first, and then wept for her publicly because of the eulogy.
Well, okay, it's not pretty much the same. I'm just saying there's two types of crying. Two types of crying. See, the second kind has to do with an appreciation of the real virtues of the person. That's not always attained. In many cases, a person doesn't really go beyond the emotional level. So that's an art form, to be able to give a good eulogy to a person. I worked on that myself over the years as a rabbi in congregation. I had to give a lot of eulogies. And I sought to do that, to really penetrate and to convey the essence of what this person stood for. Then it says that Avram got up from before his deceased. And then he spoke to the people of Ches. Now, in verse 4, he addresses them by saying that he's a stranger and a sojourner with you. And he asks them to give him a burial plot, which means it's not just for this particular person, but it's going to have a significance for the generations. That it should remain there, like today. Everybody knows about the Maaret HaMakpela. It has a certain status of significance, and people go there to pay tribute, to visit. Now, the interesting thing over here is that he refers to himself as a stranger and a sojourner. So Rabbi Soloveitchik spoke about this. He rendered it into a concept, that he said that that's the status of Jews in the various countries of the exile that they've gone to. They have to be a stranger and a sojourner. That is, by a sojourner, he meant that we're part of the society too. We're concerned about the society and we contribute to the society. We want to improve the society. So we're good citizens. But he said, we're also strangers, that when it comes to our religious principles, philosophy of life, which is based upon Torah, then we have to be strangers. We can't blend in. We can't assimilate. So he's saying basically you could be both. You could be a citizen of the country you're in and you can be part of it. And you can contribute to it, but you also have to be capable of being apart from it and not to give into that temptation to assimilate when it comes to our approach to life. Okay. Then we also see how they refer to him. take a look at verse 6. After he makes his initial request, so then they react very positively. Please listen to us. You are a prince of God amongst us. In our choicest burial places, you can bury your deceased. Not one of us will withhold a burial place from you. And then he proceeds. Because he had already in mind the place of the Maaseh Machpelah, and it would not have been a simple thing to acquire it. In fact, I asked the question that it seems strange that first you eulogize. The way we do it is that people have already acquired the burial place, and then the funeral. When the funeral begins, they know where the person's going to be buried, so they have the funeral, they do the eulogies, and then they take the person to the cemetery. Here it's strange. After the eulogies, he first goes out and he's going to try and purchase a burial place. That is unusual. But the reason I suggested, because you can see how he addresses them, that I shall bury my deceased from before me. That is, from the emotional standpoint, it created a greater incentive for them. He knew that it would not be easy. This was a choice place. And he had to do everything he could to make them amenable. And the fact that he's coming to them right from having eulogized her, and she's there, she's waiting to be buried, creates a certain pressure on them. Had he gone to them, because you can laugh, well, why didn't he plan? Why didn't he go to them before? Most people purchase a burial place before they, you know, before the time comes. And I think that had he done that, they could have easily put him off. Don't worry about it. Everything will be fine. And when the time comes, well, see, he didn't want that. That would have watered down his whole position. But now you have no choice. You have to answer me. I can't leave my wife Sarah lying around. Okay. So we do see from that a Jew, that's Avram, can attain that kind of a status. That's what we should aspire to, that in our relations to the Gentiles, Jews too, but to the Gentiles that we live amongst, they should respond with a certain type of respect. They should recognize the Jew has to comport himself in a way, I mean, if possible, where he earns people's respect. And people, that means they looked up to him. He's a prince of God. He represents the godly ways. That's incumbent upon us, at least, especially when we're in the public arena and we're recognizable as Jews, for example, wearing a kippah, or any other way in which would cause us to be recognizable as Jews. I've always said that we have to behave carefully. We can't just behave like anybody else. And we have to even go out of our way to behave in a manner that would sanctify God's name. Be helpful to people, be friendly, be kind. I mean, within reason, you know, because you have your own business to attend to. So you can't just stop and just go around helping people. But I'm saying if that opportunity comes along, like when I fly by plane and I'm wearing a kippah, so I always try to help people. You know, people need some help getting their stuff onto the overhead and things of that sort. To behave consciously, to be very courteous and friendly. Because people say, oh, this person's wearing a skull cap. He's a religious Jew. That's how they behave. So I'm just reminding everybody to be cognizant of that. Okay, so he gets the burial place and buries Sarah. And the Torah mentions that the place achieved a certain status. It was confirmed. That is in verse 19 and 20, which is after that, after the purchase. See, also notice also that they sort of have this up and back with each other. Ephraim was the owner. And Ephraim is insisting he doesn't want any money. And Avram is insisting, no, I want to pay for it. He really wants to pay for it. He doesn't want the gift. And he offers to Arba Meo Shekel Kesef. It's a field of 400. Of course, the rabbis criticized Ephraim, that he talked big, but he really wanted money. And Avram realized that. So he didn't want the gift, but also there's a difference. If he had taken it as a gift, then later on they could renege. Because when a person gives a gift, it's not like he parts with it. When a person, when you sell something, that's it. Your relationship to that thing is over. Okay. When you give something as a gift, then you sort of have second thoughts. Whenever you see that, you kind of think, well, you know, I gave that to him. You still have an interest in that object. He didn't want that to happen. So then in verse 20, it says that the field and the cave that is in it was confirmed for Abraham as a burial plot from the children of Chais. See, he wanted the place to be confirmed. He wanted that purchase to be absolute so that they shouldn't go back on it and seek to find ways to take it away from them. It's interesting. To this day, everybody knows that that's the, except for the Arabs, but everybody else knows that this is the Jewish burial place that they purchased to be a memorial. So it should be a living memorial for the patriarchs and the matriarchs. Okay, there's one glaring question I have, and this is going to be the main question around which the class tonight will revolve. Is there anything that hits you in this story? Is there anything missing from this story? Let's put it that way. Well, it seems to me that we could ask a question, because it only mentions Avram here. But where was Rivka's son? Where was Yitzchak? Was he there? Did he attend his mother's funeral? Did he give a eulogy himself? That would be extremely strange to say that he wasn't there. Yet, when Avram dies, it mentions that Yitzchak and Yishmael came and buried him. When Yaakov died, all of the sons came, took him back to Canaan and buried him. Why wouldn't it mention Yitzchak over here? What was his state of mind? Was he mourning? But the absence over here does create a question. So that's the big question of the night. And I'm going to try. It's not easy to answer this because we're asking why wasn't he there? We don't have information. So I'm going to try and put together certain ideas that hopefully will help explain that. At all events, the question now is, what happens next? So then it tells us that Avram was zaken, he was old, advanced in years, and God had blessed him with everything. Okay. So whatever travails he had gone through, it's interesting. None of the Avos, that's the patriarchs, really had an easy life. That's another interesting thing when you study the Torah. The Torah is very honest, and it's not giving you the notion that all you need to do, like religion in general, tries to appeal to people that, the reason why you're having problems and so on and so forth is because you don't believe. They do convey that idea that once you believe, you have God on your side, everything is going to be good. I think that's the sense, right, that most religions try to give you.
Certainly with Christianity, that seems to be true.
Christianity, even Judaism, I would say. I think
Judaism tries to give the sense to people that life is easy?
Yeah, I think certain, like I would say, the Kirub, those who are involved in the Kirub movement.
Oh, you mean in the modern day, what people are trying to sell people?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I hear that.
I'm not saying that's true. Yeah. I'm not saying that really represents Judaism. Yeah. But those people, it's very tempting because when you get into the Kirub business, you're trying to sell a product. You're essentially a salesman. I don't mean in a bad way. But the way to sell, because people are looking for results. So the results are, you'll have a happy time. You'll have a happy life. I think that's the main thrust. And I don't know that it's true, though. I agree with you, because you take a look at the great people in the Torah, and they didn't have such easy lives. Who would you say had the roughest time of the patriarchs? Well, especially look at the matriarchs, look at the business. So many of them were barren, couldn't have children, the whole fertility issue. Until, things changed and God answered them. Who would you say had the roughest time?
Yaakov.
Yeah, I would say so too. Very, very hard life. Once he left home, his whole, you know, the whole conflict with Esav, who wanted to kill him, and then with Laban, he keeps going from one to then his own sons.
And yeah, that's what I was thinking of, sons and going up and back to Egypt or dealing with Egypt.
Yeah, he definitely had, except for the last 17 years of his life, when he goes down to Egypt and he's reunited and Yosef is the head of the country and so forth. That seems to be that he didn't have, you know, but that was really the end of his life. And Yitzhak had his share of tough times. Abraham also, as soon as he came to Canaan, there was a famine. He goes down to Egypt. And he has Sarah has to say that she's his sister and she's taken to the house of Paro. Then subsequently, the same thing happens with the Avimelech. So he too had his battles. But I think Yaakov had it the roughest. So there's no guarantee that if you serve God, then it's going to be, you know, everything's going to be happy-go-lucky. It's just not the case. Now, so at this stage of his life, so Avram is old, and then he speaks to Eliezer. Eliezer was his servant, well, literally slave, but the word slave is bad over here because it has a bad connotation. But he was the servant of Avram, and apparently he was a tremendous intellect. He was a big Talmud Chacham, as we would say. And now, what's next on the agenda? Next on the agenda is to obtain a wife for Yitzchak. So right away, it's strange. Well, so why doesn't Yitzchak go and look for a wife for himself? You'd assume that the person himself should look for his own wife. Vice versa. You know, a woman should look for her own husband. That is, well, here we have this whole concept, which is pretty much gone out of vogue, but there are circles of Judaism where you make the shidduch, where it's based upon a shidduch. So people, that is, the parties, the bride and the groom, they don't go looking for each other. But rather there are designated, it's called the shadchanim, who suggest the match. Then if the two families are in agreement, so they'll have a couple of meetings, because in Judaism, it's absolutely prohibited for a person to marry someone sight unseen. Because he may wind up hating her, or she may wind up hating him. So they have to, but they have like two or three meetings. I don't know, not probably what modern secular people would call a date. And that's it. If they're in agreement, which means I suppose that if they don't find any major obstacle or flaw. So now he's appointing Eliezer to be the finder, the wife finder. And then he makes him take an oath. Out the conditions. First is that he should return to his birthplace, that he absolutely does not want him to take any girl from Canaan. Apparently because the morality level in Canaan was very low. So anyone that's going to come from that environment is going to have defects. It's not going to be someone who's going to fall in line with the lifestyle. The lifestyle of Abraham is the lifestyle of what we call Kedusha, the lifestyle of holiness. So that's an important thing. You don't begin your search among people that are very unlikely to be in line with your lifestyle. But apparently he came from Haran, and either it's a question whether he's sending him back to his extended family, and these people were generally on a high level, or I'm not sure if it's specifically the family or just from that place, from that locale. But of course, over there, you're going to have to pick the right one. It's not enough that the person comes from that locale. And then he is, if you take a look at chapter 24, verse 5. So then, see, Eliezer was very smart. So he says, what if the woman will not want to come after me? Because basically what Abraham was demanding, was requesting, whatever, was not a simple thing. First of all, to find the right girl. But then if you do find the right girl, so there's another condition. She has to come here. She has to come to Canaan. Now, essentially, what does that mean? In that day and age, that means she's going to leave her parents and probably never see them again. You know, they didn't have email. They didn't have transportation. To make a trip like that is something of a How often would a person do a thing like that? So essentially, you're asking a girl, and she's very young, and that's it. Sight unseen, she's going to leave everything and come to a strange land. That's not an easy thing. So then he says, what if the woman doesn't want to come with me to this land? Shall I bring back your son to the land that you have left? That's a logical point, right? That, okay, it'd be nice if she would come, but what if she doesn't? So I should just drop the shidduch? So maybe I should bring him there? So Avram said to him, guard yourself, lest you bring my son there. Then he says, Hashem, God, the God of heaven, who took me out of the house of my father and the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and swore to me, saying, to your children I will give this land. He will send his angel before you, and you shall take a woman for my son from there. Oh, that sounds very, very confident. No problem. What are you worried about? But then Avram says, the next verse, but if the woman will not want to go with you, then you shall be absolved from this oath, but only my son do not bring back there. Now, don't these two verses a little bit ambivalent here? Because in the first one, he's saying, God, who took me out of my father's house, and so the God will send his angel before you, and it'll be worked out. But then he says, but if not, then don't you dare go bring him back there. But what do you mean? You just said that God's going to take care of everything. So what are you saying that, but if not? What do you mean if not? It seems a bit of a contradiction, because he starts off by assuring him that this is a matter of divine providence. Anybody?
I mean, it seems kind of strange, because it doesn't seem like Yitzchak went with him anyway.
No, he's not taking Yitzchak, man. That's the whole point. He doesn't want Yitzchak to leave. Right. He wants Eliezer to go. And
he finds someone to bring her back.
I trust you. I trust your judgment. But there's another condition, that she may be the right woman, but if she's not going to leave, and then you're going to have to bring Yitzchak. No, can't bring Yitzchak there. So now I would say as follows. When Avram tells him that the God who spoke to me and promised me and so on and so forth, he will send his angel. See, we're talking about the divine providence. And when it comes to divine providence, unless you're a prophet and you have a specific message from God, you don't know how it's going to go. But so that, what do? You have to use your judgment. You have to act rationally. But you can't act, embrace a plan which may not be that rational on the basis, yeah, but God will help us. So like, for example, if you go out to Israel today, and people who follow, I don't know, I'm just making it up, an example, you know, we should do this, we should take over all that territory, and so on and so forth. Something which doesn't make sense, which is very, very dangerous. But, and if you object, say, 1 second, that's very dangerous. No, but if we do, because there are people that speak this way, if we do what God wants us to do, then everything will work out. Really? You're not in a position to say that, because how do you know God's plans? In specific. So therefore, to take a position, which even though it's very religious and so on, but which is dangerous in and of itself, and then to say, yeah, it's dangerous, but I know that God's going to protect us, you're not allowed to do that. You know, you can't, as the rabbis say, you can't rely on miracles. So Avraham over here was giving him his read, so to speak. The way I understand, Avraham had tremendous insight in these matters. The way I understand it, it's very, very likely that it should work out with the help of God. But I can't say so for sure. That's why I can't say for sure. But if not, if it doesn't work out that way, and the girl does not want to come back to Canaan, so no, that's the answer to the question. You can't bring him back there. So then what happens? So what happens to Yitzchak getting married? So here there's an argument. There's an argument between Rashi and the Ramban. Rashi says, you'll be absolved from this oath, and then you could choose a wife from, he had allies in Canaan, Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre, we read about it. Okay, so then I'm giving you permission to choose a woman from Canaan. You tried your best, you couldn't find. Okay, but the Ramban disagrees. He says, no. All Avram is saying is, you can't, that remains in place. He said, do not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. But what changes is that you'll be absolved. You'll be absolved. That is, you fulfilled your promise, your oath to me, and that's the end of that story. What will happen about Yitzchak getting married? God will, whatever, leave it. We'll leave it in God's hands. So I wanted to raise this question. I can understand the Ramban because he's being consistent. Avram gave him the terms, and they're not negotiable. Just like it's not negotiable about bringing him back to Haran to bring Yitzchak back, so too. He also said, you're not to take a woman from the daughters of Canaan. So that's also not, that's absolute. But Rashi, you have to ask this question. Because according to Rashi, it's not consistent. That is, with regard to the point of bringing Yitzchak back, that's absolute. There's not, that's not negotiable, no change. But with regard to the other point, not to take a daughter from Canaan, that, okay, if you did your best and you tried and you couldn't find, then you could do that. So why? Why is it that with regard to the first thing, there's no give? It's absolute.
Going back to Haran.
With regard to going back to Haran, do not do that under any conditions, even if you can't find anybody. With regard to don't take a girl from the daughters of Canaan, that, okay, if you tried and you couldn't find, then you can do that. You can be released from that portion. Why is it, according to Rashi, that it works that way? Does everybody understand my question?
I think so.
Well, if anyone doesn't, please talk up. I'll try to clarify it for you. Can you briefly say it over for everybody? Mendel?
Yeah. So Rashi says that taking Yitzchak back to Haran to find a wife is an absolute no-go. It's to the degree that if a woman that Eliezer finds that would be willing otherwise to go there, if she, I guess, met Yitzchak first, that can't be the case. And so he must go to Canaan and choose a woman from Canaan to marry Yitzchak. But he absolutely under no conditions can go back to Haran, as opposed to Ramban, who says that, so that's Rashi's position, and that seems to be the question. Why is Rashi willing to go along with that? Is that accurate representation of what you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So I'd like to suggest something.
So I guess, like, what's really the other option? I mean, if Yitzchak needs to get married because that's who is meant to carry on, you know, the prophecy that Abraham had, you know, in terms of passing on his legacy, what's the option? He's going to have to get married. So if he can't go to Haran, then he's going to have to choose a local girl. So I'm not sure I really understand.
Well, the Ramban says that leave it to God. I don't know.
Oh, so that's Ramban's position.
Exactly.
Position.
God will come up with something.
Okay.
You'll find, I guess, since that's God's will, that this should be perpetuated and given the land, so something else will come along. Okay? But he's saying in terms of what Avram instructed, you can't do something which is wrong. And you can't argue, well, if that's the case, how are we going to inherit the land of Israel? Whatever. I mean, that doesn't give you permission to do something which is wrong.
Right.
So I think like this. I think Rashi is saying like this. I think there's an important point over here, that you see in the Torah that there's two different kinds of things. There are certain areas where there can't be any compromise, and what we call Yahar Gvial Yavar, a person would have to give up his life rather than violate. There are certain things that I would use the term absolute. That's a very important characteristic in Jewish history. There are situations in which you simply can't compromise. I mean, you see that by Mordechai when he refused to bow down. Now, why? We can't do that. This is the Jewish nation. The Jewish nation can't indulge in idolatry. Oh, but you'll be threatened. Whatever. We can't do that. And eventually, of course, God saved them. And throughout history, how many times did the Jewish people, they were threatened? It wasn't they were only the Nazis, by Christianity, to convert, forced conversion. The Spanish Inquisition, And if you converted, you'd save your life. But, you know, Jews by and large said no. They gave up their lives. Because this is an absolute. There's no room for compromise. But there's another theme in the Torah also. And that is, I would call it the ideal. There's the ideal and the absolute. The ideal is something you want to strive for. This is the best possible situation. So you want to strive for it. But sometimes you can't have the ideal. And when you can't have the ideal, it doesn't mean all or nothing. So you take something which may not be the ideal, but you can work with it. You can improve it. You don't give something up just because it's not the ideal. I think you'll find many things like that. Everybody's always searching for the ideal, like a job. You want a certain job. Or a person wants the house or the car, whatever it is. See, the problem is that people misidentify. They treat an ideal as though it were an absolute. But that's something you compromise. You can't get that. You can't get the best possible one. Does that mean you shouldn't have any cars? Does that mean you shouldn't have any job? So then you take the best you can get and you work, you're out, you improve, and eventually you'll get there. Truth of the matter is that many of the things that don't appear to be the ideal, if you really put your effort into it, it turns out afterwards that this was better than what you were searching for. So I would say like this, that's what Rashi is saying, that with regard to going back to the land, no, he must stay in Canaan, because that pertains to his essence. That's his whole purpose in life. His whole purpose in life is to continue the work of Avraham. Avraham had established the basis, the foundation, to call out in the name of God, to teach people Torah. That was his essential role. When it comes to that, he can't give that up. Now, the marriage is very important. And of course, that would be the ideal. The ideal would be to take a girl from that locale. Yeah, but that's the ideal, if the Rashi is saying. If that becomes impossible, take a girl from here too. You can work, you can teach her. You'll deal different challenges. But that should not be something which is all or nothing. Because marriage is not the purpose of life. That is not the purpose of life. The purpose of life is to perfect yourself, to achieve the highest level of existence that you can, and then to help others, to teach others, whatever the case may be. Now, in order to fulfill that, you have certain needs, and a marriage partner is very, very vital, very, very important. But you can't sacrifice. It's important because it helps you to facilitate the real purpose of life, but you can't sacrifice the purpose of life to achieve something which is supposed to be a means to help you, to help you attain.
I understand. If I spend 12 hours a day in Talmud Torah, should I absolve myself from getting married?
No, that's a different question. In fact, the Torah does have that concept. The Torah has the concept of one whose Torah study is his work, so to speak. He doesn't interrupt his studies for virtually anything. But all people are expected to, you know, perfect yourself in Torah, but also to get married. But the getting married is not the prime thing. That's secondary, I would say. It's a means to facilitate.
Okay, so you're going to say it's a means to perfection.
Okay. It's a means to perfection, because you need a partner. But the purpose of the partner is to help you facilitate the purpose. I know it sounds strange because today everything is just about the emotions and about romance.
I think I understand. I just wasn't sure what you were saying. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I'm suggesting that Rashi is saying, that we're dealing with two things over here. One is the absolute, and that can't be compromised. The other one's the ideal. But there's room to make adaptations. You can't always get the best. Well, I mean, in practically speaking, it is true. A lot of people, they don't even get married because they have such high standards. It's all imaginary. But you may find what you consider the ideal. You may not. And then, I hate to use these terms, I mean, because they take away all the romance from it, but then you settle. There are many people in this universe that settle. And many of them find that they're better off because they settled rather than have gone for the one that they, imagined, that the fantasy was attached to. So you settle. So I wanted someone tall. I wanted someone that was blonde, you know, the whole bit. But what you realize afterwards that should not have been the thing which caused you not to get married. That wouldn't make any sense. Okay, I want to move on. I hope you got to this point. Yeah.
I want to ask a quick question, I think, on Rashi. If there's such a absolute about not bringing Yitzchak back to Haran, then why are we even choosing away from there in the first place? Ostensibly, we don't want to bring Yitzchak back there because Haran is a horrible place. Or I guess maybe my question is, why? What is the reason that we don't want to bring Yitzchak back to Haran, even to find him a wife? Is there something specific about Haran itself?
I would say it's not that specific, but it's rather he belongs in Canaan.
But he's not going to be gone long. I mean, he can go there.
No. It meant that she's not coming to – that means he would be gone long. He'd be gone for years, maybe the rest of his life, because she doesn't want to come to Canaan. So that means even if he comes there, she's not going to go back with him. That would mean he gives up Canaan and goes to Haran.
So that's the essential idea. The fact is that somebody must be brought to him in Canaan where he is.
Yeah, and stay there. In fact, later on when there's a famine and Yitzhak starts to go to Egypt like Avram had, God intervenes and tells him, no, that's not for you. You stay here.
Okay. All right, thanks.
All right, so let me I don't want to run out of time. All right, so I want to take up two more things. I want to take up the test that Eliezer devised. What was the idea behind it? And then the Torah does describe the actual quote-unquote taking or marrying of Rivka. So what was the test itself? The test was, you know, the damsels, I guess is the word, the maidens, would come out. I guess in those days, the young girls would water the sheep. They were shepherds. So he said that he'll be standing there, and the maiden, to whom I will say, please turn, tilt your pitcher, that I may drink. So he's going to ask her for some water. And she will say, drink. And then, v'gam gvalecha ashke. And also, I will water your camels, meaning all of your camels. So that's the one that you have designated for Yitzchak. And in her, I will know that you've done chesed with your servant. Servant is Abraham. So the thing is like this, and then it all works out amazingly. She's a beautiful girl. She's a beautiful young girl. And he goes to her, and he asks her to give him a bit of water. But so she'll respond. She gives him some water. That in and of itself does not seem to be such an astounding thing. Many people would be happy to give you some water. But then of her own accord, she has to offer to water all of his camels, which is that's a task. That's a daunting task. But notice, not that she's willing to do that, but she has to come up with that of her own, which is always the interesting part of this. But why not ask her if she'll water the camels? No, even if she would have agreed, it can't come as a response to a request. It's got to come of her own accord. So he's going to, get her attention by asking for some water for himself. And she gives him. And then she says, and also your camels I will water. What's the idea behind that? What characteristic is he looking for?
He's opening up a door for her to walk through, of her to show kindness and sensitivity to the needs of his caravan.
Okay, just one thing, that's correct. But why? What if she wouldn't say that? Why doesn't he proceed and ask her? And then she said, "Yeah, of course, I'll do that. I didn't know that. That's what you wanted. Something along those lines. That wouldn't be good. If he has to ask, then that's not the girl. Right. It's got to come from her own heart.
Because that shows. It shows a quality about a person. It shows a quality of openness and giving and being emotionally sensitive to the needs of others and empathetic.
And you wouldn't say that she's empathetic and sensitive if he asked her?
Yeah, I would not say that. I would say that she needs to be prompted. She doesn't have that awareness. I would say that she's not really available in that sense.
Yeah, I would say that exactly, that there's a higher level. It's chesed. But it's kind of like what the prophet Micha said, that what does the Lord your God request of you? right? Except that you do justice and love chesed. Love chesed. Love what we call loving kindness. So there's a difference between a person that operates out of a sense of responsibility. So that, okay, you didn't ask me. And if you ask this person, they will respond because they have a sense of responsibility. However, in and of themselves, they're not going to offer it. And that wouldn't be a bad thing. But a person that's like Rivka, like you said, has a sensitivity, but she also has a love. If a person doesn't have a love of chesed, then they have to force themselves to do it. And that's a high level. That's a high level. But there's different kind of people, like people that are very hospitable. They're always having company over for Shabbos. But many of those people really enjoy. They have fun. They really enjoy, you know, feeding people and having them over. They're very sociable. But what about people that aren't? There are people that don't feel that way. But nevertheless, they do it because it's a mitzvah to do it. So they overcome their emotions and they do it. So in my opinion, that is more perfecting. You know, the person that really has the inclination and just enjoys the company and all that, okay, it's a mitzvah. I'm not saying no. But I don't think it's the same level as someone that, by the way, that's not someone who loves chesed. That's someone who loves people. But somebody who really doesn't enjoy it would rather be without and goes ahead and does it because it's a mitzvah. I think that's a high level. So that's what he's talking about over here. That's not the level of chesed that the house of Abraham and Sarah represents. So he's looking for a very special kind of a person, very unique kind of a person. And then he finds her. And then the rest of that chapter deals with, that's the next challenge is to get her to come with him. And for that, she obviously has a liking for this person and is very, she wants to go. But
she doesn't like you for Eliezer.
Well, not Eliezer, I mean, a positive attitude, not a liking in the sense, because she's not going to marry him.
Right.
But he was very positive about him. And then he tells the family, he gathers the family and he tells them what his mission is and about Abraham. And they were related, distant, they were like cousins, you know, the family. So then he gives them presents. So, you know, wealth is always good. That's always a positive thing in these kinds of negotiations. And he gets their agreement. They said, May Hashem, he tells them the whole story. They agree that this is from God. We can't, what can we say? We can't say a word about this. So they're in total agreement. Then he gets up early the next day and he wants to start on his journey. And they say, oh, no, we give her time. You know, let her, like they say, gather her trousseau. You know, they didn't, a girl had about a year or so to get prepared and so on and so forth. But he couldn't do that. See, because he recognized you can't take chances with this kind of thing. Once the opportunity is here, there are certain things, it's a very important lesson in life because people tend to put off things. But there are certain things that you, when the opportunity presents itself, you got to do it right away. You know, seal the deal because who knows what's going to happen in the meantime. And then by a year later, everything can change. So that he convinces them. But they said, let's ask the girl. You see the character of Rivka because she says, I'll go. She wants to go. So she's very proactive, Rivka. Then the Torah describes, see, he kept her by his side on the journey to protect her. I would say also to give her all the background, the information about the kind of household that she was coming into. Now let's take a look at the description of the marriage. Okay, so they bless her and she takes leave of them. This is now in chapter 24, 62. Yitzhak came from Be'er Sha'alachai and he was dwelling in the land of the Negev, which is the south. Then it says that he went out to meditate in the field before evening and he lifted his eyes and he saw. And camels were coming. So he saw the party. Then it says that Rivka lifted her eyes and she saw Yitzchak. and she jumped off the camel. And she said to the servant, who is this man that's coming across us in the field? And the servant said, he's my master. So she took a veil and covered herself, which of course is demonstrating her, what we call tzniyus, her modesty. All right, then the servant, that's Eliezer, told Yitzhak everything. He told him, you know, I guess all the events, the test he had made and what occurred and the negotiation, the whole thing. Now here's the key phrase, the key verse. This is 67. It says that Yitzhak brought her to the tent of his mother Sarah. And he took Rivka, the word Vayikach took means he married her. And she was a wife for him, and he loved her. And he was comforted, he was consoled for the his mother, after the death of his mother. This is a very, very fascinating pasuk. What does the Torah have to tell us that he was consoled? The Torah generally doesn't reveal the emotions of a person. That's not the approach of Torah. Yet over here, it chooses to reveal his emotions. Other questions about this verse is that it says that he took her, she became his wife, and he loved her. Well, there's two questions. First of all, what's so unusual about that? I mean, most people love their wives, certainly at the outset. So why is that so strange? And also, what about the order? Because in our society, which comes first, love or marriage?
Love.
Love, generally. But here it says marriage, then love. So the Torah is telling you something. And what does it mean when it says he took her, which means he married her, and she became his wife? Well, that's, isn't that redundant? Of course, if he married her, she became his wife. That's the automatic.
Right.
Okay. So I want to suggest that perhaps I'm going to see if I could answer somewhat the original question, why the Torah doesn't describe Yitzchak as participating in the funeral of his mother. But see, the idea over here is that the Torah is talking from a different sense. You can marry a person, but that doesn't mean that she becomes your wife or that he becomes your husband. That's something else. Marriage itself can't create that. It means that a certain bond, a certain relationship is established. And very often, you know, people get married and that doesn't follow. The relationship doesn't click. It doesn't. That's why he's saying over here that that he married her. But after that, they bonded. She actually became his wife. Because the whole idea of Eliezer and the test and the whole marriage for Yitzhak revolved around the fact that he was attached to these virtues, to these ideals. And see, today a big problem is that the marriage is based upon a superficial attraction. And that's all there really is. There's nothing behind it. So when that attraction wears off, then there's nothing. The people aren't connected to each other. But if the person that you are attracted to also share the values and you love them because of what they represent, their virtues and their values, so then you have a connection. That marriage will last, even not only will, well, the secondary, the sensual attraction will remain in effect. It won't. But even so, the love is not just rooted in the sensual attraction. You really love the person. See, when you're just attracted to a person and there's nothing more, you don't love the person. It's just an attraction and you create a certain fantasy. The fantasy that you become attached to is just a figment of your imagination. So here it's telling us that the real love is the love that is established after the marriage. Usually in many, many cases, they fall in love, they get married, and that's it. Then the love just wanes. But here the love gets stronger because the more you relate to each other, the sensitivity, the wisdom, the kindness that each one displays, so the love of the person gets stronger and stronger. See, then it says that he was comforted for the loss of his mother. So what I think that, why is the Torah telling us this? I mean, that seems to be a personal, you know, fact about his emotions. Why do we need to know that? See, it's more than that. I think it's telling us this is the real mourning. The real mourning that Yitzchak had for his mother was that it made a tremendous impact upon him. And he couldn't be consoled. He couldn't be comforted, because you can imagine the connection between them. I mean, you can imagine how much she loved Yitzchak. This was her miracle child of her old age, which she had never even expected that she would have. And we know the character of Yitzchak. So in my opinion, this is my opinion, Yitzchak, there were very few people that Yitzchak could marry, because his perspective, his image of a woman was shaped by Sarah. That was such a great person in terms of her wisdom, her compassion, her sensitivity. You can imagine. So when he looked for a woman, I mean, that's what he was looking for. That was the image of a woman that was in his psyche. So the story over here, I would say there are very few people, very few women in the world that could have reached that standard, that he could be attached to them, that would evoke, that it would evoke for him the image of his mother, Sarah. So that's what the pasuk is saying. Then he was consoled. That, I would say, means that all the love that he had for Sarah now had an outlet. Now it had an object to which it could attach itself. And now he was made whole, so to speak. I'd like to quote to you from the Radak. This is part of what he says. It says that he says on the words that Yitzchak was comforted after his mother. He says, after he was mourning for his mother, even though there were 3 years had gone by. 3 years had gone by since her death, because he was 37 when she died and he got married at the age of 40. So 3 years had gone by, and normally a person gets over the mourning 3 years, generally within a year, up to a year. So he says, even though 3 years had gone by since she died, still he mourned for her, and he was comforted with this, because she was tough, she was good like his mother. So I want to suggest, perhaps,
Radak just says she was like his mother?
Yeah, in his mind.
Okay.
Well, I mean, he doesn't say that. I mean, I'm making that deduction. He's saying that through her, he was comforted for his mother, which means okay. He took the place. She took the place of his mother. So I'm saying perhaps, I mean, there's tremendous important ideas over here, but that perhaps that's why the Torah doesn't describe that he attended the funeral, things of that sort. Because that's superficial. That's not the real. It's telling you over here. It's telling you over here 3 years later when he gets married, so you can see the tremendous impact that the death of Sarah had on Yitzchak. And that's the greatest honor to a person. I mean, to actually base one's marriage seeking the characteristics of the mother is the greatest tribute that you could possibly pay to the memory of that person.
Okay.
All right. Think it over. I think I've used up my time.
So you want to say he's finding a woman who will live out the example of his mother.
Yeah. Yeah. And perpetuate those ideals.
Right. Okay.
And that's on two levels. First of all, for the sake of Klal Yisrael,
right.
You have the next matriarch. Also on a personal level, that his own personal fulfillment and his ability to overcome the grief. I mean, this is telling you in retrospect that he had tremendous grief for his mother.
So, okay.
He didn't just ignore the yeah.
So what does a person do who doesn't have an example to find a husband or a wife?
What do you mean doesn't have an example? If you don't have it from your own parents.
Right,
so there are
right.
people that you've established. You meet other people, rabbis, their wives, rebbetzins, so on and so forth, and plus you study. So you have to discover what those ideals are and what you should be looking for.
Right.
Which is not an easy thing. I'm not getting into that now. My right. marriage counsel. But that's a different story. But I'm sure we're discussing it here in the abstract way, in the abstract sense. Okay, fellas and girls, I think my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Nice to see you.
Good night.
Okay.
Okay.
So bye-bye. Take care. We'll see you. Be well, everybody. Be well.
Bye. You too.
Bye. Okay. Thank you. Okay. And me.